Lawrence Prospera is a community-driven, nonprofit organization committed to our mission of strengthening the individuals and families of Lawrence, Massachusetts through the development of thriving neighborhoods. Sisu presents Hola, Honest Opinions with the Lawrence Attitude.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. We have a very special guest for you today. Community activist, city council member, former member of the school committee, Lawrence High School graduate of Suffolk Law School, chairman of the City Council Public Safety Committee, and was involved with the new mayor's campaign. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Mr. Pavel Payano.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Payano. Do you mind if I call you by your first name?
You can call me Pavel, whatever you'd like.
Okay, Pavel. That's a very interesting name. Tell me a little bit about your name.
Sure. I was born in the Dominican Republic. My father named me Pavel. There was this book called The Mother. And in the book, Pavel was the main character, even though the title is The Mother.
Really?
And it's about, Pavel is actually a Russian name. Oh. So if you're from Russia, you would call me Pavel or Pavel. Pasha. That's a nickname for Pavel. The main character basically led this like revolution to help out his community and stuff like that. So that's what he named me after, and it means humble.
Oh, I love it. That's one of the advice my father always gave me: stay humble.
Stay humble.
You know, always. Yep. So let's take it. I know you're a very busy individual, so let's jump into these questions. Have you lived in Lawrence your whole life?
So no. So as I said earlier, I was born in the Dominican Republic. I came here when I was 6 years old, started second grade. I was actually talking to a teacher that I happened to catch in front of City Hall, and I came in 1991. So it was December 24th, 1991. And literally 30 years ago. So
wow.
30 years ago in a couple of days, I came to this country and I've been in Lawrence ever since.
Wow, so when you first arrived, you came straight to Lawrence or did
Yeah, so I think, you know, my father first came to this country, I think it was like in the 60s. His family's been in New York City for a really, really long time. So when we first arrived here for the first like week or two, we were in New York. But my dad was already a teacher in Lawrence. So as soon as we spent some time with some family in New York, we came up here.
Oh, that's very interesting to know. There's always a connection I see between Lawrence and New York City, or just Lawrence and New York.
Yeah, well, I think of a lot of Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, that's where they first got started, and the mills attract, or like the jobs that were available in the 60s and early 70s attracted a lot of people to come here. I think Cubans were here first, then Puerto Ricans, and the Dominican diaspora came in, and for the last 50 years, it's been a center where Latino culture has flourished. So right now, a majority of Dominican and Puerto Rican. I'm pretty sure in 20 years, it'll be some other group.
I love it, and I think it's what makes America, the best that it is, the diversity that it has.
Right. Unfortunately, that's not all of America, right? Like, it's just, there's something special about Lawrence. I mean, it's the immigrant city.
There is.
But there's something special that you...
The history.
I wouldn't say just the history. I think it's the people. There's that. What attracts me to Lawrence is the people. What keeps me here is the people. It's the fact that even though we're almost 100,000 people, when I walk the streets of Lawrence, there's this sense of camaraderie that you have with folks. Like, I remember when I was going to law school, somebody, this old man, I have no idea who he is, he said, Pavel. I'm like, yes. He's like, how's school going? I'm like, school going is great. And he's like, great, I'm proud of you. And he just walked away. And I was like, how does this man know my name? How does he know I'm going to school? Yeah. And he literally was like, he was literally proud of me, you know?
Yes.
Like, so I was walking with a little, like, skip of my step, you know? Yeah, but that's, you know, you find that in Lawrence. In other communities, it's not so much like that. There's this sense of you don't know your neighbors, you know? Like, there's this sense of you're basically there. It's like you and your family, and there isn't this connection to everybody else.
I see. Now, what schools did you attend? I know you just mentioned law school. Tell us a little bit about
that. Yeah, sure. So when I came here, I was 6 years old, and I went to the second grade.
Okay.
So I had just turned six, so I was very, very young for the grades that I was in. I went to the Frost School, graduated there, I think it was like 1998, went to Lawrence High School, was there for my 4 years. Then I went to UMass Amherst, graduated from there with a degree in political science. I was also the student government president at UMass Amherst. And you know, interesting story is that the guy that founded the student government in UMass Amherst was actually a Dominican guy from Lawrence, named, I believe his name was David Nunez.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was really interesting. You know, it was really cool. Like, as you're looking at the history, you're like, oh man, like, you know, Lawrence folks, you know, wherever we go, we make an impact. I then, years later, I got my master's from UMass Boston in Master's of Science in Public Affairs. And then just recently, I went through law school and I graduated from there. From Suffolk Law.
Now, let me ask you a question. I know you said that when you were 6 years old, you came here and you started second grade, you said?
Second grade, yeah.
Second grade. So does that mean you started first grade in Dominican Republic, or did you have some form of education?
Yeah, no. So I started pre-K in Dominican Republic. So I'm pre-K, kinder,
so you
first
got to
grade,
both.
And half a second grade. Yeah, but it was such a long time ago that, like, I barely remember. You know, I have like certain memories, you know.
Yes,
I think most of my memories are actually rooted here.
Okay. Now, what drove you to get involved with politics?
So I think that, you know, my parents instilled in me this drive to help others, and this sense of that you're responsible for your community and the world. What drives me is what my parents taught me, and in other part, it's also my faith. You know, one of the things that I believe in is that you've been put into this world to do good and to basically help your fellow brothers and sisters, and, you know, the world, you know, in itself, not just humans, but like your environment. So those are some of the things that drive me to do the work. When I went to UMass Amherst, it was right after September 11th. So we're talking about 2002. There was a lot of animosity for people of color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more for people that look Arab. And you know, if I take my mask off, you would be like, "Oh, he looks Arab." And I think,
oh, really?
Yeah,
yes,
no,
you're right. You're right, but I see what you mean, because my son, I get the same thing. He's not even like, they don't even guess him as Hispanic. They think he's somewhere from the Middle East.
Yeah, well, the thing is like the folks from the Middle East, it's really like this melting pot of,
yes,
you know, African, European,
a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. You know, like for the last like thousands of years, people have congregated to these areas. And when you look at Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, it's the same. Like, you know, folks in the Caribbean, pretty much the same thing.
That's
like,
right.
Like, we're very mixed looking. So you can drop me in like India, and people will be like, I wonder if he's Indian. You know,
that's
like,
right.
Yeah,
I get the same thing too with Philippines and Asia. You know, like, I think the Latino heritage has a little bit of everything as well. Like, all the when, you know, the new world and the old world met.
Yeah,
well,
know, I mean, because
a whole new race of Latin people.
We're literally a mix of Native American, the different tribes from Africa, different countries from Europe. Like, it's all sort of mixed together. During that time, there was, within UMass Amherst, there was this big push to privatize, which meant, before I got there, there were 800 Latinos, 800 African Americans that were going to UMass Amherst, and the students didn't think that that was good enough. They were fighting for more. By the end of my first year, there were 400 Latinos and 400 African Americans.
Oh, wow.
So it was cut by half. And the student, the administration had said that they wanted, basically they were putting things, putting their efforts in essentially privatizing the school. So that means increasing the GPA score that you would need to enter UMass, and also increasing the costs. Also at that time, the student government, they were very xenophobic. So basically, you know, like there were comments being made like, if you were born in Puerto Rico, you should go back to your country. And, you know, the Puerto Ricans were like, well, this is my country. Like, do you not understand, like, Puerto Rico, you're a U.S. citizen, you know?
Yes.
And that's really what motivated me, like, understanding, you know, coming from Lawrence, where I had, my friends were Cambodian, Vietnamese, Irish, you know, obviously Latino, since we make up most of the community. But, you know, late 90s, there was still, you know, diversity within the student body, and we were all poor. So, like, it wasn't like, oh, you're from so-and-so, because, we were all poor. So, like, you know, we all sort of connected through that. So I never understood, you know, racism at this, like, this level of toxicity that existed at UMass. So I was basically put in a place where either I let this happen, right, and I'd be complicit in it, or I would do what I needed to do to try to stop it. And that's, I became an organizer there, ran for president, won, helped others get elected to different positions, and also started advocating for having public higher education in Massachusetts to be affordable. And to be, you know, basically what we want is a good, affordable education for working class people. So, you know, and I still, and that's really was my drive into getting into politics. I worked for the Massachusetts Democratic Party. I was their outreach director, so I was like their youngest director, because I got that job straight out of college. It took a lot for me to get there. I think the first job that I got, you know, I was looking to do more than what they had given me. I remember I basically had to go out on my own and do certain things for them to, like, to catch notice. And then once they saw what I was capable, I got promoted, you know, fairly quickly, worked for Governor Patrick. We got him elected, ended up working for Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, helped her get elected, became part of her inner staff. I was a special assistant. And when I left Tsongas' office, one of the reasons I left was because I was like, oh, I need to basically strengthen my education, my academics, right? Like, I didn't want to just, like, I saw a lot of issues going on, and I wanted to have the background that I could say, like, this is the type of things that need to get done. So that's when I got my master's in public affairs, and I also was working at a food stamp office, so welfare. So I was a SNAP social worker.
Okay.
And so I got to experience that and just see, like, you know, we're putting, you know, while it's a very beneficial program, it's a Band-Aid on the issues, because we weren't really, we had at the time, it was at the heart of the foreclosure crisis. It had over 900 cases. There were people that would come in that I really wanted to, like partner with them and try to, you know, get them the resources that they needed to get, like, life skills and get them better jobs. But with 900 cases, that's really, really difficult.
And lack of resources.
And
so
definitely. Yeah. So I learned a lot about that. And during that time, I was also, I started a young professionals network in Lawrence. It was really great. We had a lot of educators there, and they told me, Pavel, you should run for school committee. And I was like, no, listen, I'm not even done with my master's program. I can't run. I'm not educated enough to be in the school committee.
Yeah.
So anyways, they pushed. I decided to run. And my first day on the school committee, I was very nervous, because I'm like, man, I'm around these folks. I was the youngest guy there, and I'm just like, ah. Like, I'm not capable enough to do this. The meeting started, and this individual, school committee member, said, the purpose of Lawrence High School is to teach the kids English so that way they can go work at McDonald's. And I was like, oh, like, he's being sarcastic. And I look around, I'm like, oh, sarcastic, but everyone's serious. And I'm like, oh my God, this guy's being real. So obviously I raised my hand and I was like, listen, no, like, this, the purpose of Lawrence High School is to make sure that kids have the opportunity to go wherever they want, you know, to be the leaders of tomorrow. Now, if it so happens that a kid graduates from Lawrence High School and is like, I want to be the manager of McDonald's, good for you, right? But that's not like
the goal.
You know what I'm saying? Well, not even the goals. That's not like the what do you call it? The roof. You know what I'm saying? The roof should be, you could be whatever. Like President of the United States.
Oh, that's right.
That's difficult for anyone to be, right? Mm-hmm. There's only been so many. It's difficult. But like, that's where you want your mentality to be. That we're teaching them the skills they need, academic, life, professional, in order to do whatever it is that they want
to
do.
And to believe in themselves as well, that they can accomplish whatever it is that they put themselves
through. Correct. And I would say that like, that was probably, like there are two defining points in my life that pushed me down this road. One was at UMass where I organized this group of like over 1,000 people. We were protesting what was going on at UMass when it came to race and the privatization of the university. And we had to march into the administration's office. And the president of the student government at the time, he got scared and he was like, I don't wanna march there. Because like they're, the cops are filming us, and technically, you could, if you get arrested, they could kick you out of school. And I remember that he had the bullhorn, and I said, bro, we gotta go in there. And he's like, oh man, no, I don't think I can do it. And I'm like, ah. And I took the bullhorn and I was like, all right, we're going, right?
I love that.
So that was like one point where I was like,
a defining moment
where I was like, yeah. And then I would say, the second one would be that moment when I sort of raised my hand and I spoke, and I understood that the conception that these individuals had that were running our schools was not correct, and that there was no one within that body that was speaking out and speaking truthfully of what what should be the expectations for Lawrence Public Schools. And that pushed me to really get involved, and I've been involved since then.
I'm so happy to hear that you did get involved and you took the initiative, and you're committed to it from what it sounds like.
100%.
Why are the programs like CSU important to you and, in the mission that you're carrying on with the youth and helping the community?
Yeah, so I would say I think that the type of youth that CSU works with are youth that have fallen through the cracks. I think that our social makeup, we have a lot of great programs. We have free public schools, but none of that is perfect. Some of these things are less perfect than others, and people fall through the cracks. So as a teacher, I was a teacher for the Department of Youth Services, a math teacher, and with almost every youth that came to me, sometimes there were issues within the family, but a lot of the times there were issues that if the school system or if there was a program out there that would have identified this child, this family as going through XYZ, that this kid might not be in front of me on that day, and they might not have done what they did. So I see CSU as a program that would be able to give these youth that have incredible, incredible potential a new view of life. Because I think a lot of the youth that I happened to meet were like some of like the nicest kids,
true.
But like they believed, they have a certain belief system. Some of them, were committing crime for business reasons. I remember this one guy was like, I gotta feed my little brother and little sister, right? That's what that's what he told me, and I know he believed it. And there were others that were like, the group that they were running with are like his family. Right, so like there's a lot of things there that need to be unpacked. And I think that CSU has a certain vehicle to do that unpacking. And so it's like unpacking and then like packing it up, but in a stronger way where these kids have a stronger vision of what they could do. Some of these youth are like, they would talk to me about like, oh yeah, like they're gonna die by the time they're 24 or 25, right? So like their vision is very short term. So just even being like, oh man, like when you're 70, like that's just too far off for them. And it's also this thing that as a youth, when you're in your teens, I mean, even when you're in your 20s, when you're in your teens and you're in your early 20s, you're not, like, being 30 is, like, really far, you know?
So it's
even,
old.
It's old, yeah. No, even, like, you're 17 years old, being 24 seems old.
Yes.
You know? So it's this now, you know, once you hit 30, you're like, oh, yeah, 50, that's right there. So it's this helping kids, like, wake up a little bit to the realities of life and to know that they have options. Mm-hmm. And if that they focus on it, they could get to where they want to be.
Yes, I agree with you totally. And I feel that at this point, some of our schools are failing our children, you know, in the way that they're just, like you said, falling in the cracks and they're not really paying attention to the bigger picture.
A lot of schools, yeah, no,
and
no.
It's really sad because we're paying a lot of money for these schools to be able to operate and provide our youth with the best education that a public school can give them.
So here's actually, so I'll step back and say, like, that's actually not true. So what the law says, so the state of Massachusetts gives cities, has a requirement that cities provide an adequate education, not a good education, an adequate education.
The expectation is a good education,
so,
right?
So I would even step back because what the law says is adequate. What they should provide is an excellent, not even a good, an
Thank
excellent
you. No, no,
education.
You're right. You're right.
You know, like what I would talk, you know, I always talk in the city council because there used to be issues before I jumped into city council. The city of Lawrence wasn't providing what was required by law far as funding.
Okay.
So in Lawrence, the city only has to provide 4% of the of Chapter 70 money, and that money goes to LPS and, you know, the different charter schools. Just 4%. For years, it was not providing that 4%. At tops, some years they provide like 1%. So while I was in the school committee, I wrote a report saying that the city owed, just in Chapter 70 money, the city owed close to $25 million to the Lawrence public school systems. So for those that went through the Lawrence public school system in the 90s, in the early 2000s, and you looked at it and you're like, wow, like half the kids dropped out, there's no resources. Yep, there was no resources in part because the city was not providing those resources. So for the first time, about 4 or 5 years ago, was the first time that the city of Lawrence actually covered the 4% that were required by state law. But what I always talk about is that the law says adequate. Now, if you told me that you were seeing a doctor, like, you know, talk to me about your doctor, and I said, oh, that doctor's adequate. If I told you, like, go see this mechanic, he's adequate. Go see this dentist, he's adequate. Go see this barber, he's adequate. You're going to be like, oh, no, like,
no, I'm
good.
Like,
maybe not even the best. Like, I'm going to go for someone that's good, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Like,
wow.
But, yeah, so what state law just says, it's just just requires the bare minimum. Adequate.
Is that just for the city of Lawrence, or is that just
for the entire state? Now, what cities do, so the state says you have to provide the minimum adequate.
Uh-huh.
What cities do, like Waltham, your Andovers,
uh-huh,
you know, cities that, one, are wealthier, but also have this different view on education, mm-hmm, they're like, all right, so we have to provide, let's say adequate is $250 million, to get it to good, we have to bring that up to $300 million, right? So they figure out how to get that extra money to put it into the budget. So that's what these other cities and towns do. And I think that we are slowly getting at that level. You know, so like my big advocacy point is, okay, so the cities are actually responsible for the buildings in the school system.
Okay.
For years, we would say we weren't going to fix the buildings because we'd be like, oh, Lawrence Public Schools has a budget of $200 million.
Mm-hmm.
So why should we fix that? They have a huge budget. But yeah, that budget that was given to them by the state that we weren't paying that 4%, that money is for books, it's for education. City has a responsibility to fix up the school.
So they don't touch that budget that's supposed to be going
to education. Exactly. So what's been happening for a very long time is that money that's supposed to go for that, they were taking to fix,
wow,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And even in the last 8 years, we've had some of that. So every time the state sends the school department money, mm-hmm, right? And they're sending money for books for teachers, right? For the education pieces. Sometimes the city administration wants to be like, oh, listen, so you have to, I'm just going to make some stuff up. Like, there's a boiler that you need to get. Use some of that money to get that boiler. Uh-huh. And I'm like, no. That's just not how it works, right? Like, so if I'm renting and you're the landlord and I just happen to get some, I win the lottery, right? You can't come to me like, oh, listen, take that lottery and like change the toilet. You know, like there's the lights have, electricity's having issues. You pay for that. No, you're the landlord. You pay for that. So that's one of my big advocacy points in trying to make sure that the city does commits to the responsibility to take care of our school buildings and to support our youth education.
Well, especially right now with, I don't know if you heard what's going on in the news with Lawrence High School. I think recently it was all over the local news about the violence, and security and the kids going out of control. And a lot of the kids were coming to us here saying, you know, we don't feel safe there. Can we drop out and come to your program? And we're like, no, that's illegal. Right. You guys can't do that.
Right, right.
But they were saying, complaining to us how they didn't feel safe in school.
Well, you know, so I would say that we're in a interesting kind of point in like Lawrence's timeline where our schools, they're under state receivership. So technically they're under state control, but there's actually, it's called the Lawrence Alliance for Education. They function like a school committee, and it's actually made up, a majority of them are actually local people. And they're actually in control. So these local people are actually in control of our school system. But there seems to be a sort of separation between like the leadership and what the community is looking for. And there's definitely, you know, like I'm as chairman of the Public Safety Committee, we had meetings for months. We had meetings on this issue. And what we were seeing is just, we're going to have these meetings early in the year, and we're hoping that change has come. I'll say that a lot of schools nationwide were suffering through some of this, and what expounded on the issue is that Lawrence High School has like staffing problems. So they have staffing problems because they entered the school year without hiring the number of teachers that they needed, and also because of COVID. So on any day, you might have 40 absences. So if you have 40 absences and there's 250 employees, so it's 40 absences I'm talking about entirely, right?
Okay.
So if you have 250 employees and 40 of them are absent, that's, you know, that's a lot. So that means that administrators now have to cover teachers. And then, so who's walking the halls, right? So if you need 5-6 security guards to for Lawrence High School to be safe, and you only had 3, and one of them got COVID, right? Like, so you're stuck, and it's a lot of that was going on. So it's a staffing issue, and it's also, I think, like a leadership issue, and I'm hoping that we're soon resolving that.
Yes, I hope so too, because this is the youth right now is the future that we will see in the next years to come. So it's important that we prepare them to be able to, you know, confront the future.
Facts.
And you guys were, you know, the city of Lawrence, so just the state of Massachusetts, the whole United States will see the reaps of it, you know, they'll see the results of it. So, and they will also see the results in a negative way if we don't do the right thing by them as well. So what do you see as some of the good things happening in the city of Lawrence right now?
Yeah, so I would say, I think I said earlier, I think one of the best things that we have is our people. When the gas crisis hit, I was running the Arlington shelter, and every day I had tons of volunteers, like dozens upon dozens of volunteers helping out and bringing food and people just stepping up. And they were like, you know, folks that were like no longer living in Lawrence, you know, were like an hour away, came up and like, I want to, support my community, right? So that's one of the amazing things about Lawrence, that I think that when we come together in moments of crises.
I love that.
Also, I have a lot of hope, like looking back at Lawrence in the last 20 years, I've seen its leadership change, and I've seen this more forward-thinking individuals get into office, more forward-thinking individuals be employed by the city. And I'm really hopeful that momentum keeps going, and that we keep building Lawrence up, but at the same time thinking about the people that are currently living here. Because I think that sometimes when folks are thinking about how do you move a city forward, they're moving the city forward as they're pushing people out. Mm-hmm. And my view is we got to move our city forward, but we got to look at our base and like work with the people we have.
That's right.
You know, and push them up.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So definitely, I think that's a main ingredient in that stew.
Yeah. Listen, we have right now, I remember when I first started the school committee, my first year, I recommended that we start a program where we could get 5 kids from Lawrence High School to take classes in Northern Essex and graduate with like a 1 year of 2 years of schooling from like credits, right? So I was like, if we can do 1 year, that'd be amazing. But if they
that
can take,
would be amazing.
Yeah, so like that way a year of school would be done. And I was laughed at. I remember like folks in the room were laughing. They're like, it's impossible. It can't be done. And I was like, oh, I guess that's impossible, right? 7 years later, Lawrence High School has 200 to 300 kids that are taking classes at Northern Essex and Merrimack College. And they're coming out with between 1 to 2 years of college credit. So they're going to your, unit. Like, think about how much money these kids are saving.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And already they're getting prepared, because what ends up happening for a lot of Latinos, mm-hmm. And kids that come from like urban public school settings, the ones that are able to escape their public school system, because I feel like sometimes public school system tend to push folks in different directions, right? At least when I was going to Lawrence High School, folks were being pushed to the army, folks were being pushed to become like these 2-year trainings, mm-hmm. and there wasn't this big push to get them to 2-year two-year colleges or 4-year colleges. So these folks that are able to get to the 4-year schools end up taking 5 or 6 years or dropping out and not completing their degree. So mm-hmm. if they come out with at least a year's worth of college credits, that's a foundation that they can use. So that's one of the things that is really exciting me, because mm-hmm. right now I think the percentage of people in Lawrence that have more than a high school degree is less than 20%. I think it might even be less than 15%.
Oh, wow.
So that's something that needs to be improved.
Definitely, definitely. And it starts today.
It starts today
so that we can see the results later on. What are some of the areas where the city continues to struggle?
I think, like any other city, like we have, the results of poverty, right? So, we're dealing with hunger. And people don't know, there's a lot of kids right now that are hungry right now. Like, folks don't understand that.
Yes.
They think that just because people are getting food stamps that solves everything. I'm like, all right, listen, if I gave you only $200, right? If I gave you $200, you have to eat for a month with those $200, would you be able to do it? No. Most folks don't know how to do that. And because food stamps... Food stamps does not cover,
especially with the price of
inflation. The price of food, yeah, no.
Yes. You can't really do not much for.
You might get a good 2 weeks. So hunger is
a week. I think with right now prices, it's just incredible the prices of food.
I think hunger is a big issue. I think education is a big issue. Mm-hmm. I also think there's this the cost of rent, the cost of putting a roof over your head.
What is going
has
on
increased
with that?
Steadily. Over the course of the last several years.
Amazing.
What hasn't increased is the amount of money that you make. So people are still working Los Chocolates, people are still working in these places, and they're not, they're not able to even cover rent. They're barely able to cover rent. I remember a few years ago, I was talking to this man who was delivering me pizza, and he was telling me how this, like being a pizza delivery man, was his third job. So he was telling me it was his third job, and the reason it was his third job, and his wife had 2 jobs, it was so he could pay the rent and he could be able to save some money so that when his kids go to college. And I was just like, oh my God, these folks have, there's 5 jobs there, right? And they still are wondering if they're going to be able to put their kid through college. If you went back 40, 50 years ago, if you worked at a factory, just working at that factory was enough for you to buy a home and go on a vacation once or twice that year.
Now that's
just not the case. Even folks that are middle class, right? Like most people have a hustle. There's like there's something else that they're doing. You know, like I have a. I was just telling someone. I was like, I technically had, you know, last year I had three jobs. You know, I was working my 9 to 5. I was a city councilor, which is technically part time, but in reality, it's like all time. Uh-huh. If you're at the supermarket, people are asking you questions. You know, and I was also, you know, I was doing consulting work as well. So most people are doing more than one job, right? And I think in part, it's because in order for us to have the standard of living that we want, this American dream, the American dream for a lot of people is simple. Folks who want to own a home and be able to relax with their, you know, with their family here and there, and make sure that their family are set up to be at a different place than where they were at, this upward mobility.
Yes.
Unfortunately, our economy is not necessarily being too helpful for folks that are middle class, working class people. If you're lucky enough to get to the top, right, and you're making, you know, $200,000-$300,000 a year, then you're probably living pretty well.
Yeah.
But for those of us that aren't, it's a whole different situation. So I think one of the things that I'm very afraid of in Lawrence is gentrification. I see a lot of policies, that, and I feel like the policies over the last 20 years, it's moving, it's pushing people out. Mm-hmm. The fact that right now, you know, it's, I think, $1,400 for you to get a two-bedroom.
A right? studio at that price.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, like these two-bedrooms. So it's a funny story. I was talking to somebody 2 days ago. I was visiting a friend. He has a three-family in not the best area in Lawrence. And we're looking at the second, his apartment, the second floor, and it's a two-bedroom. And the apartment, it just doesn't look nice. It's like, it looks bad, you know?
Adequate?
It, like, it's, no, not even not even adequate. Okay. I was like, ugh. Like, oh, man. Like, I'm thinking, you're like, yeah. I'm like, yo. So he's like, yeah, I'm having somebody move in a few days. I'm like, oh, man. So what do you charge? Like, $700, $800? Uh-huh. And he's like looking at me like, no, like $1,500. I was like, $1,500 for this? Like, this is garbage, bro. And he's like, oh, man. Like, I'm being good. This right now could go for $1,700,
oh,
you know?
Wow.
Because he's offering parking as well. And I'm just like, holy. But that's how things are right now. So if you have, you know, you're a single mom with a kid, you know, two kids or whatever, how can you afford that?
And how can you be a parent, at least an adequate parent, you know, to raise a good family, healthy, where, you know, and I think that's a lot of the problem we see with our kids here. When I ask them about, like, how, you know, what is it that you, you know, why did you drop out of school or why are you here? A lot of them go into details how mom was not around or how daddy was not around because they were busy working.
They were busy working.
You know, and it's like, then it let, you know, it gives them that time to get in trouble or know somebody, nobody supervising them. Or giving them structure, you know? So it's just, it's a really
listen,
struggle.
100%. I feel like if parents were more at home, then some of these issues might not arise.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But it's this thing, as a parent, you know, you have these parents who are like, you know, I'm working two jobs. And the reason they're working two jobs is so that their kid gets a good education. But because they're not at home, they're not able to make sure that, you know, things are going right. Yeah, no, so I think that there's a lot going on there. There's a lot to unpack when it comes to gentrification, poverty, and the housing situation we have in Lawrence. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems we're going to have. And I think it's a regional issue.
I think
a lot of people want to live in Lawrence, right? And they're willing to pay these crazy prices. So you have to unpack that. Like, why are they willing?
Because
it's like, but what about the location? So the reason is that when you come into Lawrence and you're Latino, you have less stress. Because you can walk around everywhere and you see people that look like you. You speak your own language.
Yes, yes.
There's a certain level of respect that you have. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're in a different community, you might get someone to be like, hey, you're in America, speak American. You know, or you might get, if you're in a different public school setting, your kid might say something in Spanish and the teacher might say, hey, like, don't speak Spanish.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So you're like, or you might go to the doctors and there might be no one that can, you know, talk to you in your language. Right? So I think that's why people are willing to pay what they pay.
Mm-hmm.
If other communities surrounding Lawrence were more sensitive to folks' culture, I think that we would have less people, you know, like the demand would go down, right? But also I think there's certain policies that need to be put in place to make sure that we are, again, as I said earlier, we're supporting the people that are here.
I agree. I totally agree with you. You couldn't be more right than that. And the fact that you're not forgetting what's important within the community, you know, it's the working families. We need that in the United States. And
right.
I think that the way we're going, we're going to lose a lot of that. And mm-hmm. that's what makes the fabric of the United States. It's not really the rich or the poor, but it's the working, the person that wakes up every morning and goes to work and makes it makes things happen every day, you know? You see that on the highway. Everybody, I know I see that at 5 o'clock somebody gets up. I know that those are the working families that are making everything happen for us. The person that has to open the restaurant, the person that has to open the coffee shop, you know? So it just really matters. Now, what makes you hopeful for the future of Lawrence?
So some of the things that makes me hopeful, again, I said our people, the youth. What makes me hopeful is, man, I have a lot of love for my community, and just seeing other people that share that love makes me believe that that there's always hope and there's always an opportunity for change. As long as we're breathing, there's always an opportunity for us to do better for ourselves and those that are around us. I'm a big believer that. We live in a world that there's always ups and downs, but mm-hmm. I think the arc of the universe, like Ben Stiller's, like truth and justice, and that's my view. And you know,
I love that.
So like that's why I do the work that I do. And regardless of what happens, regardless anytime that there's downs, I'm always like things are going to improve and things are going to get better.
You never give up the hope.
100%.
It matters. Now, what are your favorite top three books?
All right.
Or movies that you can share with us?
Okay, yeah. So I love To Kill a Mockingbird.
Ooh, okay.
I would say it's like my favorite hobby is reading books. I love reading.
I love that.
And I love, I'm a big fan of fiction.
Okay.
To Kill a Mockingbird is one of my all-time favorite books. I also like, it's called Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett.
Okay.
It's like historical fiction. It's really, really incredible. And then, you know, as a youth, I really liked David Copperfield. Mm. I read that book like a million times. It was David Copperfield and The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh,
were
wow.
Like, you know, like middle school, high school, those were like my two favorite books, yeah.
What about movies, if you have any?
Movies. You know what? I can't think of any right now. But you know, I really liked Avatar.
Okay.
Yeah. No. I'm. Yeah, man. No. I like watching TV shows as well.
So, what's your favorite TV show now? Or if you could share with us one.
Yeah. So I loved Game of Thrones until its last season and those last few episodes.
Yes,
now I don't even want to talk about Game of Thrones, but I was obsessed with Game of Thrones. There's this new show on Netflix called what is it called? It's like the Wizard. I don't remember what it's called, but I'm totally in tune with Netflix every time there's a new show out. Yeah.
It's fiction. It's
I like fiction. Well, the thing is like, you know, when you're doing the work that we're doing, right, where you're constantly seeing, some of like the bad parts about society,
yes.
Right? Like you're mm-hmm. dealing with folks that are sick, you know, folks that are passing away, mm-hmm. folks that are going through, they're about to be kicked out of their apartment.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard. That when it's time for you to relax, for you to like see that again, right? I need, you know, you're looking for when you're watching TV, a distraction,
yes,
to like escape, you know?
Okay.
Folks are like, oh, Pavel, you only like movies and books that have a happy ending at the end. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, last thing I want to do is read a book and it's a sad ending. Like, I'm gonna be pissed. I'm gonna be mad. I'm like, I see sad endings all the time. Well, not sad endings.
Reality,
because I never think it's a sad, you know, I see people going through sad moments,
mm-hmm.
and I hope that I'm able to help them, like, get to where they want to be. Sometimes you're dealing with youths all the time. Like, you know, some of the hard hits, I remember when I was a social worker, I got this young woman to apply to community college. It was very hard.
Ooh, I love
hard.
That.
Yeah, we spent weeks talking about it. We finally got her to apply. She was very happy about it. We did the application together.
Ooh,
right?
Wow.
Put it on the envelope. I had the stamps. All she had to do was turn it in.
Mm-hmm.
9 months, a year later, she comes back to me. And I'm talking to her. I'm like, so how was school?
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I didn't go. And I'm like, what do you mean? And what I realized was this young lady was extremely motivated while she was with me. But then she went back to her original setting, and that just brought her down.
Yes.
Like, there was no hope there.
And nobody
right?
believed in her.
And
probably,
no one believed
you know?
In her.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So she saw around herself no one that had gone to school, and she dropped it. Even though she was an incredibly, incredibly bright kid.
Yes.
So, like hearing that day, probably that week, that brought me down, right?
Yeah.
And it's one of these things that I think that you constantly have to keep thinking that you're helping folks and that you're somehow pushing that needle forward.
I love that. I love that. It sounds like you're a great community activist and you're doing
100%.
Great things in the community.
100%.
I love that.
Yeah.
Now, we're almost to the end. What are the top three most influential people in your life? And if you can share a little bit as to why they are.
Most influential people in my life. So I think that I think my parents are some of, you know, like the top influential folks in my life. I mean, my dad taught me how to, the most important skill, two of the most important skills that I've learned and that have carried me throughout my life is a love for reading.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If it wasn't for this love,
beautiful gift, yeah.
If it wasn't for this love for reading, I never would have finished college on time. Because I you know, I came into college and I wasn't prepared for college. And I had to, I mean, this is for, like, even in law school, mm-hmm. like, you know, you saw yourself that wishing that you had known some foundational skills. And you know what, like, so each time what I ended up doing was just picking up books and just start reading, start studying, start, like, you know, like, learning stuff that you should have learned when you were in the fifth, sixth grade, right? So that's one. And two, to think critically. My mom, she taught me, so one of the reasons that I love To Kill a Mockingbird is because in To Kill a Mockingbird, there's this this theme of that you have to walk in the other person's shoes to understand who they are. And that even when you have certain characters that you might be like, I don't like this character, that by walking in their shoes, you get to understand them. You won't agree with them. You probably might not like them. Yeah. But at least by understanding them, you have a better idea of why these individuals think that way and what got them there. So it's one of the things that my mom would always talk to me about. And I think that's one of the reasons that I've been successful in bringing people together and creating bridges between individuals that disagree with each other. You know, when I always talk to folks, you know, I have folks that be like, I disagree with everything you say. I'm like, it's impossible. It is impossible for you to agree with everything that I say, for anyone to agree 100% with me.
Yeah.
And it's impossible for everyone to disagree 100%.
Yes.
There has to be at least, we probably agree on 10% of the things. Let's figure out what those 10% are,
yeah.
and let's work on those.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and we'll go to war on the other 90, right? But at least that there's this bridge, and I find that every time I find groups that are opposing of each other, once there's a connection and they start working together, they end up becoming less likely to see themselves as others and less likely to attack each other,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's like how do you bridge these folks? And I think my parents, the skills that they gave me from a very young age, helped me get there.
I like that, and I think they blessed you with very important skills. And I think that that's another issue we're missing in our education system, where we're not teaching our kids to start using their critical thinking brain. You know, like, put it to work. Think. Don't let no other people think for you.
Right. Well, I mean, well, that's the education system. So with the education system, public education system started right at the start of the Industrial Revolution. And one of the reasons it started is because, leaders at that time understood that they needed a different workforce. Like, you know, you couldn't just have farmers. You needed people that knew how to read. You needed people that could follow instructions. You needed people that could be managers of these people, right? We're in a different workforce right now. We don't have these factories. These factories, you know, pretty soon robots and drones are going to replace everything. Like this man that was a pizza delivery guy, in 10 years, it's going to be a drone that's going to be delivering the pizza.
That's true.
So essentially we need leaders of tomorrow and they need that critical thinking and other 21st century skills.
Yeah, because even that drone needs somebody to repair it when it breaks down, you know? So we need those engineers.
We need entrepreneurs. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to wrap it up with the last, it's not even a question, it's more of a request. Where can people find you online or your contact information where the audience that support what you're doing can reach out to you?
So I have a website, pavelpiano.com. People can find me there. They can find me on Facebook, Pavel Payano. It's PavelPayano. Also on Instagram and on LinkedIn. Luckily, there are very few people with my name. I think there might be only one other Pavel Payano in the world. So I'm very, very easy to find. You can literally Google me and you will find me also on our city website under city councilors, my name, city email, and telephone number are there as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for inviting me. This has been excellent. This has been a really great conversation, probably longer than what we initially imagined. But we talked about a lot of great things. And I invite anyone listening that has questions for me to send me an email, ppayano@cityoflawrence.com, or find me on social media.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
This podcast is brought to you in part by Lawrence Prospera and is recorded in the multimedia room at the Sisu Center. Nuria Rivera is our host and Paul Thompson, our engineer and director, with assistance provided by young adults at the Sisu Center. Technical support provided by Tony Schumann. Our producer is Paul Heithaus. Executive producers are Jay Bartosik, Ralph Guerrero, and the Lawrence Prospera Board of Directors. Thanks to the generous support of the City of Lawrence, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Executive Office of Health and Human Services, and the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. Thank you to the New Balance Foundation, the Filene's Foundation, the United Way, the Nordson Foundation, and the Essex County Community Foundation. And a big thank you and shout out to the Maximus Foundation. Without their support, this podcast would not be possible. And lastly, a very special thanks to our guest for sharing their stories with us today.